All right. So I forgot to turn on the sound.
So the abridged version is Euler's logarithm is the sum of z to the n over n squared. By using an integral formula, you can get it to be defined on the complement of a branch cut extending along the real axis from 1 to infinity. And it's known to have 8 special values, and those are the only 8 that are known, where both z and dialog z can be written in closed form. So there are functional equations, and the functional equations we will have reason to use. So let me write some of them down. There's an equation for the dialog of 1 over z, and it's minus dialog of z minus pi squared over 6 minus a half log squared of minus z. And that's, in fact, how half of those 8 values were obtained. Almost half. Hey, why was it minus a half on this list? Did he lie to me?
Oh, you have a repetition.
I do.
The second and fourth in the second column are the same. Oh, wait, no, never mind.
No, they're not. They're conjugate. I see. This shouldn't this give me dialog of 2 out of dialog of 1? For some reason, maybe it doesn't. I would have thought, doesn't it seem like if I applied this formula was equal to, I would get a formula for dialog of 2?
The reciprocal of it will
be... Oh, dialog of 2 is out of the range. Ah, that's the point. Yeah, okay, sorry. Thanks. Dialog of 1 minus z is minus dialog of z plus pi squared over 6 minus log z times log of 1 minus z. And what these two imply is that the following 6 functions, dialog of z, dialog of 1 over 1 minus z, dialog of z minus 1 over z, minus dialog of 1 over z, minus dialog of 1 minus z, and minus dialog of z over z minus 1 differ, pairwise differ by elementary functions. Elementary functions being, you know, logs and pi squared over 6 and things like that. So this sort of set of modified versions of the dialog rhythm, where you might put in these expressions, don't change things very much. And some of you will recognize what those expressions are. Those are those arise when you're trying to understand how to make fractional linear transformations in for 4 complex numbers work. You put 3 of them at 0, 1, and infinity, and then you've got the fourth. But you can choose an ordering of 0, 1, and infinity, and that gives you a different fourth, and so it gives you a bunch of functions which are supposed to be the same, and we're about to give an interpretation of that. We can't quite do it yet because of these error terms with the logs. So there's that collection of identities. There's the duplication formula, which tells you the dialog of z squared is twice the dialog of z plus the dialog of minus z. And more generally, the dialog of x is n times the sum over the nth roots of x of the dialog of z. So for n equal 2, this is this is what I wrote here. But in general, you can take, for any x, you can take a set of nth roots, add up those dialogues, multiply by n, and you get the same answer. Then there's the two-variable five-term relation. So the five-term relation says that dialogue of x plus dialogue of y plus dialogue of 1 minus x over 1 minus xy plus dialogue of 1 minus xy plus dialogue of 1 minus y over 1 minus xy. So that's my five terms. Is equal to an elementary function, which is explicitly pi squared over 6 minus log x log 1 minus x minus log y log 1 minus y plus log of 1 minus x over 1 minus xy times log of 1 minus y over 1 minus xy. Okay. This relation was discovered by Spence in 1809, independently by Abel in 1827, independently by Hill in 1828, independently by Coomer in 1840, independently by Schaefer in 1846, and, Xavier says, doubtless others. So I don't know how you notice that, but five people in the 19th century independently noticed it. And then there's the six-term relation, which says if, this is the last one, six-term relation, which says if 1 over x plus 1 over y plus 1 over z equals 1, then dialogue x plus dialogue y plus dialogue z is equal to a half of dialogue of minus xy over z plus dialogue of minus yz over x plus dialogue of minus zx over y. Okay, so there are these known functional relations, and they are really critical to what's about to come, which is why I wrote them down explicitly. Okay, so there's a strange mini-variable equation. I don't think I'm going to use that, so I won't write it down. So this branch cut is kind of annoying. And so there are ways of improving the dialogarithm function. I'm only going to discuss one of those ways today, unless I get very tempted at the end and mention the second one. But it's... What I'm going to discuss is the Bloch-Wigner dialogarithm. Physicists should not get too excited. This is not Eugene Wigner. Well, and I guess there are various Blochs that it isn't either. Spencer Bloch is a well-known mathematician, and a guy named D. Wigner, who is not a well-known mathematician. Presumably he was maybe a student or something, and helped with the beginning of this, but I'm sorry to say was not heard from again. So what we're going to do is we're going to fix up the dialogarithm by adding something that will cancel the branch cut. So we take the dialogarithm, and then we add the argument of 1 minus z times the log of the absolute value of z. And we're only going to look at the imaginary part of this quantity. So this has the effect, this removes the branch cut. And it leaves you with a function which is real analytic. It's a real valued real analytic function on c minus 0, 1. And it has logarithmic, actually r log r type singularities at 0 and 1. So So we still have two singular points to worry about, but there is a continuous extension to 0 and 1, and we've sort of extended it to most things. And it turns out that putting in this term takes care of all of the elementary function stuff that we were seeing in the original dialogarithm identities. So the dialogarithm identities can be rewritten in these terms. So the first set of equations tells you that d of z and d of 1 minus, we should really do it in the same order, 1 over 1 minus z and d of z minus 1 over z and minus d of 1 over z and minus d of 1 minus z and minus d of z over z minus 1. Those are all the same. So now they're equal on the nose rather than differing by elementary functions. So there's this sign change. And in terms of the action of S3 on the three points that you're using to do the cross ratio business, it says it's an odd function, right? The five-term relation is now just the five-term relation with no error stuff. So it's d of x plus d of y plus d of 1 minus x over 1 minus xy plus d of 1 minus xy plus d of 1 minus y over 1 minus xy is equal to 0. And the six-term relation
for the previous relation, did you have an equal sign between the last two terms, or is there an extra negative?
There is, thank you, equal sign, thank you. okay, I lost my six-term relation. Okay, I forgot, I didn't realize that the six-term relation didn't generalize. So this five-term relation looks a little bit awkward until you define a function of four variables. You sort of recognize that the cross ratio has something to do with something from this one. So you define a function of four variables, d of z0, z1, z2, z3, to be the Bloch-Wigner function of the cross ratio, z0 minus z2 over z 0 minus z3, z1 minus z3 over z1 minus z2. So the fact that, so that's been set up so that it might change sign if you invert, but the fact that you can do it that way is a consequence of being able to, of the first set of relations. And then the five-term identity turns out to say sum I equals 0 to 4 of minus 1 to the I d tilde of z0 omit zi and go to z4 is equal to 0. So once you've recognized that there is this symmetry coming from these and that the symmetry tells you that there's a hidden function of four variables which it depends on through the cross ratio, then this is just a statement about the sum of those guys. So there are a couple of logical orders in which the story can proceed. There's the order in which I talk about regulators for a class number formula. And And then regulators for algebraic K-theory over number fields. And then proceed. Or there's the story that I'm about to tell now, and so there's going to be a very strange looking condition in that story, which is really motivated by this one, but actually I couldn't think of a good motivation for jumping into class number four with us right now. So I'm going to continue to pursue properties of the Bloch-Wigner function. But the Bloch-Wigner function was introduced by Bloch after some preliminary work by Wigner exactly to address these questions. So it's now used for lots of other things, but that's where it originally came from. I should mention that the... I won't mention that. What I want to look at now is hyperbolic 3-space. So hyperbolic 3-space has R2 as its boundary. It has an upper half-space representation. But you have to use a Poincaré-type metric on the upper half-space to get the hyperbolic 3-space. And there are there's a famous class of 3-manifolds, which you get by taking hyperbolic 3-space mod appropriate discretely acting groups. And so a hyperbolic 3-manifold is H3 mod gamma, such that gamma acts freely, and the volume of the quotient is finite. So I said there's a Poincaré-type metric. You might worry that a Poincaré-type metric has a scaling that you could do arbitrarily, but we're going to normalize the metric to have constant curvature. Constant curvature minus 1, in fact. So it's a constant curvature metric, and we make that constant curvature minus 1. That normalizes the scale. And that actually means that the volume of a hyperbolic metric is a well-defined quantity. Even if I hadn't done the rescaling, I could still have sorted the finite volume from the infinite volume quotients. But in fact, the volume itself is interesting. So one thing you can do with hyperbolic 3-manifolds is these can be built from what are called ideal tetrahedra. And what I mean is I want to triangulate my hyperbolic 3-manifold into these ideal tetrahedra. And that's true maybe after removing a finite number of geodesic circles. So you might have to take a small amount out before you can do this ideal triangulation, but But if I remove a finite number of geodesic circles, I don't change the volume, right? So I'll still have a good story about the volume. And what's an ideal tetrahedron? So I'm going to have a tetrahedron in my three-dimensional space. Now, you might remember from the hyperbolic plane, the upper half space, which people probably have studied more, that there's this story that the geodesics are half semicircles and vertical lines, right? And they have the property that they come in at a 90-degree angle to the boundary. But the boundary is at infinite distance in the Poincaré metric. So there's a similar thing that happens here. If I take 4 points in the bounding R2, then I get these 4 circles. And then the whole thing is sort of what's under this is this ideal tetrahedron under it, right? So this is the my picture's not so good. Get a better picture. Right. My picture's not quite so good. The better picture has a kind of, there's the kind of balloon from the side, and then the balloon from that side, and then the shorter one's like this, right? Okay. So there's an ideal tetrahedron. And so if you label, so if you choose a complex coordinates on this guy, think of that as C, and if you label the points, Z1, Z2, Z3, Z4, then the volume of the ideal tetrahedron at Z1, Z2, Z3, Z4. Anybody want to take, anybody who doesn't know want to take a guess? It's D-tilde. There's no point in spending 20 minutes talking about D-tilde unless this is what we're doing. So we get volumes of these three manifold building blocks by evaluating Bloch-Wigner, or you can think of that just as D of the cross ratio. I won't write it again, but D of the cross ratio. And then, what does this property say? Okay, so the volume, maybe there's some sign I have to worry about. Is this always positive? It's not always positive because of these minus signs in here. So probably I had to be careful about the orientation of Z1, Z2, Z3, Z4, because if I do just, if I just switch two of them, then presumably that changes the sign, so I have to be a little careful about this. Which I wasn't when I was thinking about it. But this kind of relation says if I had 5 points and I made the, so let me think of 5 points. I made the ideal tetrahedra out of any set of 4 of them. Of course, those will be overlapping guys, but you could imagine shifting things around and trying to build something out of them, and this gives you a non-trivial relation among the volumes. And actually is useful for verifying that you can sort of further subdivide things and still make sense out of tetrahedralizations. So it turns out that you can't just choose an arbitrary set of ideal tetrahedra and assume that, and this is pretty obvious, and assume that they would form a hyperbolic 3-manifold. There's at least one interesting constraint on the tetrahedra which glue together to form a hyperbolic 3-manifold. And the constraint can be written in the following way.
Is that a theorem? Is that the volume of that D-tilde?
Yes. Makes you happier, I'll write the theorem. But I'm not going to give a proof. So what's the condition? Let's let G be a group. And I want to define wedge 2 of G to be the set of symbols G wedge H ranging over G, modulo relations which say G wedge G is 0, and if I have GH wedge, it's the free abelian group on the set of symbols. Modulo some relations which say GH wedge K is the same thing as G wedge K plus H wedge K. Well, it would be a lot easier if I were writing my group additively, because then I wouldn't have used the multiplication sign on the left-hand side of that second relation. I would have used an addition sign, and then it would have been clear. The point is that the group operation is supposed to sort of translate to, I guess it has to be an abelian group, now that I think about it. the group operation is supposed to translate to the corresponding linear combination. So the group I want to apply this to is C star, thought of multiplicatively. So it's going to be expressions. It's going to be generated by things of the form x wedge y, and then as I wrote here, I'll just take x wedge x or x y wedge z minus x wedge z minus y wedge z. Sorry, that just rewriting the same thing with different letters. I'm going to work in that group. And now I'm going to tell you the relationship. So if z1 through z nu are the vertices in an ideal tetrahedralization. I don't know how to spell that word correctly, so I'm making it up, of a hyperbolic 3-manifold, then the sum from nu equals 1 to however many there are, sorry, nu is supposed to be the index, z1 to zn, nu equals 1 to n, of z nu wedge 1 minus z nu is equal to 0 in this wedge 2 group. It's a very strange formula to try to understand because I'm doing it in this wedge 2 C star business, right? So I don't get to distribute this addition over the wedge. I could distribute a multiplication over the wedge and turn it into an addition, but that 1 minus does not get distributed. But you'll notice that z goes to 1 minus z preserves c star, right? Zj are supposed to be in c minus 0 and 1. I should have mentioned over here, right, that I could always I could do a linear fractional transformation on C, which puts three of these at 0, 1, and infinity, and then you want the fourth one to be distinct. So you want it to be finite, and then you want it to not equal 0 and not equal 1. So I'm going to be evaluating the Bloch-Wigner function at values other than 0 or 1, and that's good because it had singularities at 0 and 1. So I'm staying away from 0 and 1. With my Bloch-Wigner function, and that also happens in this relation. So if I'm in C minus 0, 1 and take 1 minus z, then I still live in C minus 0, 1. So this relation was derived by follows from assertions in reference 3. This relation follows from assertions in reference 3. So we're going to introduce the Bloch group. And as I mentioned, Bloch studied this because he was thinking about regulators in K-theory, in algebraic K-theory. But we're going to introduce the Bloch group to be, so the Bloch group is going to be a set of equivalence classes. We'll think of Z1 formal sums, z1 up to zn, with z1 up through zn, all living in c minus 0, 1. Modulo, and also satisfying 10, not 10, satisfying this, such that the sum of z nu wedge 1 minus z nu is equal to 0. Modulo the relations. So what relations do I want? Well, I'm going to impose the relations that I had on the Bloch-Wigner function, written now in these terms. So the Bloch-Wigner function for z and 1 over z were negatives of each other, so I want to set that relation equal to 0. The Bloch-Wigner functions for, I don't know why it's changing into x, for z and 1 minus z were negatives of each other.
Then there was the five-term relation, which turned into this equation. One minus xy plus one minus y over one minus xy. So I'll take all of these formal linear combinations satisfying this Bloch relation modulo those equivalences. And that's called the Bloch group. And that would be the Bloch group of C. And more or less by construction, the Bloch vector function is well defined on the Bloch group. So I've got my Bloch group C, and it gives me a real number, right? So I'm taking z1 plus zn, and I'm sending it to d of z1 plus up to d of zn. Okay, I just realized that I skipped a step, which was to show that when I had an ideal tetrahedralization, that the sum of the volumes of the tetrahedra in the tetrahedralization was equal to the sum of the Bloch Wigners of the vertices. I can just write it schematically like that. So that's not completely obvious. I told you that the Bloch Wigners of the ideal tetrahedra, excuse me, that the volumes of the ideal tetrahedra could be represented by Bloch Wigners of cross ratios, but actually you need a little more. You need a slightly more global result when you're putting them together into a hyperbolic treatment. Okay, but anyway, this is going to produce, if these are the vertices of a hyperbolic three-manifold, of an ideal tetrahedralization of a hyperbolic three-manifold, then this is going to give me the volume of a hyperbolic three-manifold. And we built in this condition that the vertices are supposed to satisfy into the Bloch group. So here's Bloch's theorem. His theorem is that if you evaluate the Bloch group, the Bloch Wigner function, if you look at all the values of the Bloch Wigner function on complex z's, that's equal as a set to the values of the Bloch Wigner function on restricted to algebraic numbers. And there's a corollary, which is that d of bc is countable. And there's another corollary which is already known in other ways, which is that the set of volumes of H3 mod gamma is countable. So among all hyperbolic three manifolds, there are only a countable set of volumes. There's more structure that's known to this set of volumes. All of those volumes are, in fact, values of Bloch Wigner on the Bloch group, but because every value of Bloch Wigner on the Bloch group is the same as a value where you're restricting to algebraic numbers, there's a countable set. So there's a countable set of possible indices. Now, it's not actually easy to write down anything in the Bloch group. Okay, so here is a nice example of an element in the Bloch group, together with a check that it is in the Bloch group. So the claim is that if you take two, right, so just for simplicity, alpha is going to be
1 minus root minus 7 over 2. And beta is going to be minus 1 minus root minus 7 over 2. And so we're going to claim this in the block group, claim 2 times 1 plus root minus 7 over 2 plus minus 1 minus root minus 7 over 2 is in the block group. That's the claim. What's even better than BC is BQ bar, if you like, but it's in BC. And so to check that, what you would have to do is look at 2 times this guy. This guy is minus beta. Wedge one minus it, right? Okay, so minus beta is 1 plus root minus 7 over 2. 1 plus beta is alpha, so that's alpha. And then I have to do minus 1 minus root 7 over 2, so that's beta, and wedge that with okay, why does it say 1 over beta? Ah, sorry. This is over 4. That's not actually beta. It's actually claimed as that's 1 over beta. And alpha squared over beta. Okay, so let's see why those things are true. I miscopied. So 1 over beta is 2 over minus 1 minus root minus 7, 2 times minus 1 root minus root minus 7, divided by something or other. There's a plus. I didn't do that, right? And so it was minus 8, perhaps. So that's 1 minus root minus 7 over 4. Almost. Oh no, is that minus 8? Ah, plus. Still not quite right. Okay, so that's minus 1 over beta, I guess. And then if I do alpha squared over beta, I didn't actually work these before, these are fun. Alpha squared looks like 1 minus 7 is minus 6. Minus root minus 7 over 2 over beta, which is 2 over minus 1 minus root minus 7. So that's minus 3 minus root minus 7 times minus 1 plus root minus 7. 2's cancel. I think I have a minus 8 there. So here, okay, hopefully everybody can do these too, right? So that's 4 plus 7. I don't really like the number 11. And then minus 2 root minus 7.
What is the computation that is happening right now?
I defined these numbers, and I'm making this computation. And the reason is that Professor Zaghier tells me that the thing I'm supposed to verify has a 1 over beta and an alpha squared over beta, and he's working on this number. So I should be doing z wedge 1 minus z with this number.
How'd you get better plus 7 at 3 plus 7?
Pardon? Oh, here I was really fast. So I squared alpha, and so I was getting a term 1 minus 2 root minus 7 plus 7 divided by 4. So I've got the sign wrong. Was that plus 7? Shoot.
Yeah.
That's minus 7, right? Minus 7. So I have this sign was right. And all both signs were right. Look at that. So that's minus 6 minus 2 root minus 7 over 4, but I divided by 2. So that's how I got that. That was.
But on the last one, you got 11, shouldn't
be 10? Oh, 3 and 7 is 10. That's much, I'm much happier with that. Thank you. 3 and 7 is 10. I still am over minus 8, right? I didn't change that sign. So that looks like minus 5 plus root minus 7 over 4. And if I do 1 minus z, 1 minus minus 1 plus root minus 7 over 4, then I'm getting 5 minus root minus 7 over 4. So it's the negative of that. So indeed, minus 1 over beta is this number, and minus alpha squared over beta is 1 minus this number. This was the easy part of the computation. Now I have to actually evaluate that. Right, so what does this 2 do? This 2 behaves like two of these behave like minus beta times minus plus minus beta wedge alpha, and I get to replace that with the product, right? Because of this weird distributive law that changes addition into multiplication. So that's beta squared wedge alpha is the first term. And the minus signs are canceling. So these are reciprocal, so they get subtracted. Oh man. Well, I'm just going to write what he wrote and try to understand what is correct. 2 beta wedge alpha minus 2 beta wedge alpha is equal to 0. Somehow I have to disentangle all of these product guys, keeping an alpha squared, and somehow it's supposed to come out to be just multiplying by beta. So two relations make it work. 1 plus beta equals alpha, and 1 minus beta inverse equals alpha squared over beta. I kind of had to use that to plug into to this formula. And if I've got a pair of relations like that, I'm going to end up with them only being solved by algebraic numbers of an appropriate kind. So that's essentially why you drag algebraic numbers in to even finding small solutions to this this relation. Okay, I apologize for messing up that example so badly. Okay, so now let me describe just briefly what Bloch did. So there is a very classical story in number theory in which you look at a number field and the ring of integers in a number field. And if you tension that ring of integers with the reals, it's isomorphic to R1 copies of the reals and R2 copies of the complex numbers. That's R1 real places and R2 complex places. And so you can take a basis. Let's see. So you can embed the non-zero Q excuse me, the units in the number field into the units in OK tensored over Z with R. And then you can map this by logs for the real places and log squareds for the complex places into R to the R1 plus R2. And so this composite map is known as L. And L of OK star is a lattice of rank R1 plus R2 minus 1. Okay, so I can do this for the easy case. Easiest case is Q. The ring of integers is Z. The units are plus or minus 1. And indeed, plus or minus 1 is not going to form a lattice of rank. I mean, it's going to form a lattice of rank 0. You have to mod it by torsion. This is going to kill the torsion. You get a lattice of rank 0. Okay. That doesn't prove anything, but that's the easiest case. So there's something called the regulator, which is 1 over root R1 plus R2 times the volume of this image, L of OK star. So I have to use the standard Euclidean norm on the image space, and I get a volume. And then this regulator in number theory shows up in nice places, such as the limit as s goes to 1 of s minus 1 times the zeta function of the number field is 2 to the R1 plus R2 pi to the R2 times the regulator times the class number divided by the square root of the discriminant of the field, absolute value of the discriminant of the field, times W, and W is the number of roots of 1 in OK. W is 2 for the rational numbers. So there's the class number H and this regulator. This regulator is some transcendental guy, which combined with other transcendental guys in this formula tells you how to find an integer somehow. So people wanted to extend. So this is, in some sense, a cohomology question. And people had wanted to extend this to K-theory. Lichtenbaum had given a conjecture to extend it to K-theory, which was not quite right. And so Bloch was working on that conjecture and came up with, Borel first proved a result, which then Bloch managed to generalize into a statement in algebraic K-theory. So so Borel's result I'm not going to tell you Borel's result. What I am going to tell you is that there is something called the algebraic in algebraic K-theory, there are these groups K sub n, which are not periodic like they are in topology. But if you look at the algebraic K-group for an elliptic curve, for the scheme of an elliptic curve over the complex numbers, there's a regulator map into C. And this regulator map has the property of counting some things that are related to K-theory, sort of analogous to the class number formula. And it's serves as a substitute for the value at 2 of the L function of this elliptic curve E. So here I had zeta functions of number fields, and I was kind of finding special values of zeta functions of number fields. In this extension that Bloch did, it has to do with special functions of L functions of algebraic curves in particular. And the long and short of it is that this regulator got identified with the Bloch-Wigner function. Bloch-Wigner of I'm just going to say it in this vague way. It's determined by the Bloch-Wigner function. Okay, so how could this possibly be related to the original problem that I discussed? Well, these algebraic K groups have explicit realizations using things like this block group construction. So on the one hand, you have algebraic K groups, actually there are lots of them, of an algebraic variety, and it's described by symbols that are somehow similar to this block group. There is a very nice chapter in the study of algebraic cycles in algebraic geometry in which you realize that the Chow group of algebraic P cycles on an algebraic variety, which by Chern class theory has a map into cohomology, this map actually factors through K theory. And under nice circumstances, you can hope that the topological map into K theory sort of lists somehow to graded and filtered pieces of the K group, which are determined by this algebraic K theory construction. So there are these things that are called higher Chow groups, which map to the algebraic K groups. And those are the kinds of things that Bloch studied regulators for. And what Green, Griffiths, and Kerr showed was that limits of Abel-Jacobi maps of cycles in a natural way factor through these higher Chow groups. Therefore, the image somehow is determined by an element in a higher K group. And then if you want to map to cohomology, you end up needing the regulator. And the regulator is given effectively by this Bloch-Figner function. So we were studying a problem with algebraic cycles on Calabi-Yau manifolds and limits as you went to a singular place. And this theory tells you that that limit is described in a higher Chow group, which maps to a higher K group. Then there's this regulator theory, which gives you a number. It's a cohomology class, but it's a rational cohomology class multiplied by some irrational number, presumably irrational number. And it's given by this Bloch-Wigner function. But it's not just given by the Bloch-Wigner function. It's given in such a way that you had to build up the actual value you were looking at as a sum of a whole bunch of things obtained from some spectral sequence, and we'll get there in this series of lectures, where the assembly into pieces looks, well, let me just say, is reminiscent of building the hyperbolic 3 manifold out of the ideal tetrahedra and then applying the volume formula appropriately to that thing. So that's what's kind of got us on the track of trying to find in these specific interesting algebraic cycle classes that we're looking at, trying to find an appropriate hyperbolic 3 manifold, which we hope will be a mirror story to the whole mirror symmetry thing that I talked about last time. So anyway, today was to sort of get some of the basics of the Bloch-Figner function down. I do apologize that I should have worked through the example before coming to class. It's always a good idea, whatever you're teaching. But they do get closely related to number fields. And by the way, hyperbolic 3 manifolds also tend to be related to number fields. And this one indication of that relation is the fact that the set of volumes were Bloch-Wigner functions evaluated on algebraic numbers somehow. So that doesn't guarantee that there's a unique number field associated to any hyperbolic 3 manifold, but it's some indication that there's a connection. All right, I think I'll stop there. Any questions? Yes.
So we've related the dial algorithm to volumes of hyperbolic 3 manifolds,
right.
But we can't compute the dial algorithm, or we can compute it at 6 values, so...
We can compute it exactly at 6 values, but we can compute it numerically at other places.
Okay, and because it's countable,
so,
we can, like...
So in the computation we're doing, first there was a numerical value for the quantity at issue, but eventually it turned out to be the dial algorithm of a particular algebraic number, and those dial algorithms can be evaluated numerically. Yes?
When people evaluate numerically, you mean evaluating the integral definition the dialogue rhythm?
Well, so presumably, presumably I use the integral definition corrected with that other argument term. People have sufficient control on the numerics that they've made the following nice graph of level curves. So, I mean, there's a fair amount of control over doing this. I don't actually know how these numerical calculations are done.
But it seems like approximating it via the integral definition is better than the methods we have for calculating hyperbolic volumes of, calculating volumes of hyperbolic manifolds.
I don't know what ways we have of calculating volumes of hyperbolic manifolds.
I don't know what they use, but I know there's software packages where you
can. Right, right. But they might implicitly be going through this story.
Yeah, I don't know that. That's right. What I want.
I mean, there's Snappy and his descendants, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Snappy will draw you the entire fundamental domain, and presumably, if you've got the fundamental domain, you easily get the ideal tetrahedralization, and maybe Jeff put a formula in there for the volume that way. I'm not sure. I don't know enough three-manifold theory. I'm learning more all the time. Yes?
So you said you didn't know, in the first talk, you didn't know where those specific algebraic numbers arise.
That's right.
So why there are those numbers or whatever.
Right. It looks like I'm in a particular number field. That should be a hint about which hyperbolic three-manifold I'm going to go for. But, yes, I don't know.
So does it... So you talked about regulators in the case of these K-groups, which you also talked about regulators for algebraic number fields. And was there a connection, or it's just...
So you apply the algebraic K theory to the function field of an algebraic variety. So if the algebraic variety is just a non-closed point, then that function field is just a standard number field, and that's a theory. But this theory here is going to be applied, I guess, to the three punctured sphere, C minus 0 and 1, mm-hmm. and the K group of that guy. So, if I'm brave, the next time I talk, it'll be about these higher Chow groups and how you map them to the K3 groups. It's a little intense. So I'm trying to figure out a way to present it that won't just overwhelm you with a board filled with spectral sequences. But that'll be a few weeks.